Tommy McCarthy was born in Sheehan, 3 miles west of Kilmehill in West Clare. His father Thomas, a farmer of some 30 acres, married Kathleen Kelly from near Curraclare, and they had two sons, Paddy, who was born in February 1927 and who still works the farm, and Tommy, who was born on the 14th of November 1929. They also have a stepsister, Margaret Walsh. Tragedy was to strike early, however, as Thomas McCarthy contracted pneumonia at the age of 50 and died in 1932, leaving his wife Kathleen to raise two young children. At the age of 5, Tommy began his schooling at Leitrim National School, being brought and minded by his older brother Paddy, and both talked of always leaving by the back door of their house and crossing the fields barefoot in summertime to make the journey of about 15 minutes. The school had an enrolment of about 70 pupils. The teachers were Mrs. Honan and Pat Conway, and Tommy always spoke of it with fond memories. His early interest in music and his attendance at house dances while still at primary school was to cause raised eyebrows and regular rebukes from Pat Conway, however, who often referred to Tommy's whistle as your piccolo and would make the odd sarcastic comment as to his nighttime activities. The economic situation of the time was one of dire poverty, and politically Ireland was just emerging from the bitterness of the Civil War and engaged in the hardships of the economic war under the De Valera-led Fianna Fáil government. Much of the heavy farming work was done by Mehel, a coming together of nearest neighbours to sow and reap the harvest, to cut and save the turf, and carry out any necessary repair work. This was, of course, of significance to families affected by illness or bereavement, as the McCarthys were. Musically, the Kilmehill area was vibrant and rich, which helped to raise the spirits in no small way. The concertina was the instrument of choice, with one practically in every household, and players like Mick Stack Ryan from Sheehan and Elizabeth Crotty from Kilrush had a huge influence on people like Solus Lillis, Sonny Murray, Bernard O'Sullivan, Tommy McMahon, Tom Carey, Gerald Hawke, and of course Tommy McCarthy himself, who with Solus Lillis regularly walked across the fields to listen, learn and play with Stack Ryan. Tommy recalls his first memory of hearing live music and its impact on him.
I'd say my first interest was, I have told several people about it, on a St. Stephen's Day, sitting at home in the house. I'd say I might be 9 years old, roughly. And a lot of these fellas that I'm telling you about come. Paddy Breen, God rest him, and Mike O'Dick come in the Ran, you know. The Ran was a kind of a big thing in them days. And I was sitting at home and these fellas comes in, I suppose, playing flutes and fiddles and whatever they had. And I thought to myself, God, that sounds good, you know.
It's really your first memory.
That was my first memory, yeah. And I suppose I got a tin whistle and or some kind of a thing. As I say, it was the cheapest at the time. And I was screeching away with it like for a long, long time. And
did you teach yourself? Or
I did more or less. I taught the tin whistle myself. But then in later years, I got a fiddle. I got a fiddle from a man called Malachy Marnin, who it would be Jimmy Ward's father-in-law in Milton Malbay. He gave me a fiddle. I used to drive Mangan's van and we used to go there, and he gave me a fiddle, and I had that. And a man called Jack King, who lived back the road from us, he's dead now, he played a fiddle, and I used to go back to him every Sunday evening. And but I could never really master the fiddle. Played it a long time, but I could never really. Some of the fiddlers of today, or even then, I never satisfied myself. Mm-hmm. I would never satisfied with what I could do.
I know. You mentioned, Willie Clancy to me on a number of occasions as well. When did you get to know Willie? Was it in later years?
In the 50s too, you know. Mm-hmm. People didn't travel around so much then, you see. Milltown and Kilmehill aren't very far away, but, I mean, there wasn't too many cars, you know.
I know.
I'd go up to Milltown occasionally, but I kind of better know him, believe it or not, in London. He spent a couple of years there, you know.
Yeah.
I think from 52 to 54, and Oh, we used to meet up there a lot, you know. There was kind of a lot of music there, then Bobby Casey and all them fellas. But
You know, when you were talking to me about Willie before, you seemed to be very impressed by him, not just as a musician, but as a person and a personality as well.
Oh, yeah, that's right. He was a very, should I say, innocent. Maybe it's the wrong word, but he was an innocent, very easily, very placid kind of a fella, you know. And the least little things would amuse him, like a person's vice, or he'd never talk much about music, you know. He didn't seem to take it serious, but I think when he played all right, he took it serious, you know. But he was a real joker, you know, very witty.
Yeah, and very fond of children, I think.
Very fond of children,
well.
Yeah. He was a gentleman, really, you know.
Tommy recalled seeing a piper play at a race meeting in Kilrush when he was very young and thought it was probably the great Johnny Dorn. He played tin whistle at a fesh in Kilrush when he was 10 years old and was presented with his medal by fiddle player Mrs. Galvin of Myaste. He also recalled hearing Mrs. Crotty play in the pub in the square in Kilrush from a very young age. The country house dance was once described by Junior Crehan as his university, and indeed it was the main focus for music, song, dance, courtship and social interaction up to the Dance Halls Act of 1935. With the support of the clergy, the Act endeavoured to move such activity into the public dance halls, but the house dances continued in various guises through the 1950s and, to a lesser extent, into the 1960s. Tommy was an active participant in these while still in primary school. The fact that he had begun to play the tin whistle at the age of 9 and a type of recorder or flute given to him by Paddy Breen a little later made him most welcome at any house gathering. Here he describes the importance of the house dance and tells a lovely story concerning a night when he returns home late to find the door bolted, and he has to face an angry and concerned mother.
Definitely the country house dances, as we called them, and the farm houses, they were a big thing, you know.
Yeah.
They were a big thing. That's where I done my practice in and my playing.
Was it?
Just to tell you a little story, my mother used to put us to bed often of a sort of, you know, of a summer's evening, like 9 o'clock would be fairly early, you know, going to bed, summer's evening, and we'd know that there'd be a dance or something, maybe in your house or some little local place, and we often went to bed, and maybe after an hour or so, when she thought we were asleep, we used to get up, push up the window and off, and often to these parties.
Yeah.
I'd often got home at 4 or 5 o'clock in the morning. And she never knew we were out at all.
No.
I'd done it many a time. And to continue the story, I got caught once. Speaking of Paddy Breen, he came home from England one time, I suppose in Christmas or summer, and he brought me this lovely little, you know, the recorder?
Yep.
The wooden one of those, but it was different to the recorder, you know, it was on concert pitch. He brought me one of those, and God, I really cherished that him. I used to have it playing here, there and everywhere, going around to these dances. And as I say, once I came home from somewhere, some early hour of the morning, you know, and my mother had the door locked and we had to knock to get in. And I remember, well, she got up, God rest her, and she said to me, she said, Tom, she said, you're going to kill yourself with this music. And she got this wooden whistle and flung it in the fire.
Oh, dear.
Yeah. I mean, the fire wasn't blazing now. This was 4 or 5 o'clock in the morning. The fire was raked, as we call it.
Mm-hmm.
So I was looking there, sorrowful at this thing, and I thought, my God, I wonder, is it going to burn? And she stood there for a while too, and it was kind of just beginning to singe, should we say, and she went off to bed, and I just got it and whipped it out and put it into a bucket of water. When I got her sleeping again, I was trying it, and it still played.
Right.
And I played that thing for a long, long time afterwards.
The musician and singer Paddy Breen was born in Kilmihill and emigrated to London at a relatively young age. He returned home on holidays each summer, often taking an extended break and working on local farms when the money ran out. A charismatic figure, his visits were always eagerly awaited, not least by the young McCarthys.
Well, I had memories of him definitely when he came home on holidays, you know, everyone in Kilmihill and around the area had, you know, he was always made welcome. I think I was telling you before, when I suppose in them days money wasn't very plentiful, he'd be home maybe for a couple of weeks and money'd run out and he'd start doing a bit of work, you know. He'd go to you and he'd go to me, farmers, you know, here and there. But he used to come to our house cutting hay with his scythe. And my mother would tell us in the morning, maybe when we'd be going to school, she'd say, Paddy Breen might be coming today cutting hay. And we'd say, yeah. And we'd go to school and we'd say to the old teacher, Pat Conway, God rest him now, we tell him some old make-up story, you know, that my mother wanted us home early to do something. And he'd let us, you know, he'd believe it. So we'd run home and there was Paddy Breen with the scythe down in the field cutting hay, and we used to bring him down sandwiches and tea. And he'd have the flute in them days.
Yeah.
Play a couple of tunes and maybe stay in the house that night until 11 or 12 o'clock. Anything could happen, you know, but he was a really nice fellow. Another man too, Paddy Murphy from Grey Grove, he played one, you know, but they were rare.
Yeah.
And the ones that they had, the poor fellas, they were bandaged up with Jubilee clips and elastoplast and God knows what.
Yeah, there was nobody to repair them in those days, really.
No, not at all.
Yeah,
they were throwing water into them and throwing Guinness into them. They were full of cracks and polythene and...
Tommy sat and passed his primary cert in Carr Murphy National School and spent 2 years attending the vocational school in Kilmehill. His brother Paddy recalls how he sat at the table and played a few tunes just before the exam. It showed a coolness which was a hallmark of his in later life, but naturally enough annoyed his mother at the time. However, she later relented and purchased his first fiddle for him in Kilmehill. By his own admission, he never could master this instrument to his satisfaction, although he played it with distinction as a member of the Glenside Cayley Band in London, and passed on his love of fiddle music to Bernadette and Tommy. From Kilmehill, he went to Shields Garage in Ennis, where he worked as a trainee mechanic. While servicing trucks for Fawcett Circus one day, he decided to act on every teenager's fancy, at least at that time, and take up an offer to join them as a driver for a brief period. The drive took him to County Wicklow as a young lad of 17, but the romance of the circus soon wore off. Money was scarce, and food scarcer, and he took a lift back to the Midwest from a Limerick jobber, and he spoke of tears in his eyes when he saw again the hills of Clare. Returning to Kilmihill, he worked as a driver for Mangan's, now Mangan's Cash and Carry in Ennis, but, however, at the age of 20, in a spirit of adventure and freedom, he took the emigrant boat for England in 1950.
Fare thee well, Charlie C. Casey, is the cradle of my birth. And fare thee well to Ennis town, where there's plenty fun and mirth. Not forgetting Kildysers, with his woodlands evergreen. For it's many the pleasant afternoon I spent with my Colleen. I sailed from Londonderry in April 42, bound for Philadelphia, my fortune to pursue. I bid farewell to all fair maids and the girl I did adore. And I left my
What Tommy saw in London at the time didn't endear him to the place. Again, any romantic notions he may have had about a fresh start in a new country soon evaporated in post-war London, and he returned to Ireland a year later. After a few months at home, he again toyed with the London notion, and was just on the verge of buying a boat ticket when one of those coincidences that impact on all our lives paid him a visit.
One day I thought, I don't know, what'll I do? I packed my bag again and I head up to Dublin. And in them times, or before I left, I used to drive lorries to Dublin, you know, and we used to be picking up goods and factories and all that kind of thing. And they had a kind of a, well, some union regulations where you had to have a helper in the lorry with you, which I used to have, which you could pick up a fella in Dublin. So anyway, I knew this man very, very well, Paddy McSherry from Sligo. So I arrived in Dublin anyway this Friday night and I thought, what'll I do? I stayed in Dublin that night anyway. I had money and all that kind of thing, so I thought, I was thinking, there wasn't much happening in Dublin then either, in 1950, you probably know. So Saturday I was looking around and I thought, what'll I do? So it was coming time for the old boat or the ferry Saturday night at 9 o'clock and I was kind of getting prepared to go. And I was walking down the street, not going, but kind of thinking about it. And who did I meet but this brave Paddy McSherry again? He big shake hands and he said, where were you? And I said, I was over in England for a while. And he said, do you like it? And I said, I do not. I do not, because, you know, times were bad there then, really bad, you know, ration books. And anyway, he said, all right, would you stay here, he said, if you got a job? And I said, I would. Okay, he said, have you money? I said, yeah. I gave him some couple of bob anyway. He went into some telephone and he phoned somebody and he come back to me and he said, Stay here, he said. There'll be somebody here to see you next Monday. This was Saturday. I said, okay. I had an old fiddle then, as I was telling you. Mm. Went into some cafe or pub or something, and I suppose I got out this old fiddle and playing away, and I kind of felt happy then, you know. So anyway, somebody came to see me on the Monday. I didn't know who he was. But anyway, I realised that he came from Dinamarry in County Galway, so he talked to me about this, that and the other thing.
Was this the first time you had heard the word Dinamarry?
It was. I thought to myself, where the hell is that? But yeah. Anyway, I agreed to stay, and I finished up in Dinamarry that night, some early hour of the night, 10 or 11 o'clock, so I got a job there, and this place, they were kind of general merchants. They're doing everything, grain and shops and supermarkets and all kind of stuff, so God. The first day, anyway, we finished. He told me to go with this man, and we finished up in Dr. Douglas Hyde's place. You know who Dr. Douglas Hyde was in mm-hmm. Roscommon. Mm-hmm. For they were cutting up timber. We were moving it away and bringing it to where they make chipboard. They don't want to be making a long story out of it. I don't know. When I seen Lynn and Mary, though, I thought, I don't know now. Will I stay long here? The truth is very quiet, you know. But I got to like it. I got to like it after a while, and, you know. As I say, the long day was coming, and I was traveling around the country here, there, and everywhere. And God, anyway, a man come to me one Sunday, and he said, Tom, he said, you're a stranger around here. Yeah. He said, I hear you play music. I said, well, I do a bit. See, he said, we're having a concert here, he said, in the hall in a couple of weeks' time. He said, would you come and play for some step dancers? And I said, yeah. So I went along, you know, with my old fiddle, and these three or four girls come along, and they danced, and done their little piece, and that's the Sound of Music today. You probably heard of that place. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. It was the Esca Ballroom then. So anyway, I was talking away to these girls, who they were and who taught them to dance, and one of them girls is my wife today.
Ah,
oh,
it's a great story.
Yeah, so I stayed there for a couple of years then, I think, or maybe 2.5 years, and I don't know, I got tired of it then, from one another. You know what it's like. We're always moving here, there and everywhere, away again, back to mm-hmm. London, mm-hmm. Kathleen and all.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And
sure. Before you go back to London, it's such a lovely story. And it's great.
It was around this time that his ears were reawakened to the music of the pipes. The piper he first heard on Radio Éireann was Leo Rousham, and in 1950 he travelled to Dublin to order a set from Leo. He returned a few months later and collected his set of pipes. He drove a very short distance from the house, parked at the side of the street, strapped on the pipes, and made his first attempt to play in the cab of his truck. It was to become his favourite instrument. He returned to London in 1952 with Kathleen Timothy, and even though only 2 years had elapsed, London seemed to have changed enormously in that time. Work was plentiful, and the Irish traditional music session in pubs, clubs and dance halls were buzzing with life.
Well, the scene in London had changed immensely in those 2 years. As I say, in 1950, there was no music, or at least I couldn't find it anywhere. Mm-hmm. But when I went back in 1952, the middle of the year again, it was, God, everybody was there then, you know, like Seamus Innes and Willie Clancy and Bobby Casey, Michael Falsey, and everyone you could ever think of. Fellas from all over the place, you know, people that wouldn't be known here at all, accordion players from other parts of the country and fiddle players, and it was really good, you know. Yeah, Michael Gorman, Maggie Barry, I could be naming them for hours, you know.
Yeah, well,
Roger Sherlock. And
it seemed to have been just a great, vibrant, lively scene.
It was, you know, yeah. But things were beginning to pick up then, you know, and there was kind of loads of work and people were happy and...
Yeah. And people also talk about the Sunday morning sessions and for some reason. Were they particularly good?
Oh, they were, yeah. Yeah, they were the best day of the week, should we say. People used to look forward to them. I think the simple reason, you know, they were off work and didn't have to be kind of up. Well, they could have a rest in the morning. I think that was the thing. It's still pretty popular there, but that was the best day of the week, you know, the Sunday.
Mm, mm, mm. And where did you play music? What venues did you play at the time, Tommy?
Gee, all over the place, you know, like maybe what I think again, Tim, it's a long time ago. The Eagle, a pub called The Eagle in Camden Town was a well-known venue of a Sunday morning where they'd all meet.
Mm-hmm.
They'd only play, you know, maybe kind of for fun. Maybe the governor would give them a drink or something like that. But, you know, there was a great spirit and... The Bedford was another one in Camden Town, and then in later years, Fulham, the White Hart. Then, of course, the dance hall started up. You know, there were there was loads of them. Every street corner in London, there was Irish dance halls, you know.
Yeah. Did Clare musicians tend to stick together?
Not really.
No. Everybody mixed?
They mixed up together, yeah. Mm. You know, there was bands there. There was everyone in them, like people like Sean Maguire, Vincent Griffin. I remember Bobby Casey, Joe Ryan, Roger Sherlock. No, they were all mixed fellas, maybe from Galway, playing accordions or Kerry or whatever the case may be. You know.
And they got on well together.
Oh, the finest, yeah.
London was to be Kathleen and Tommy's home for almost the next 40 years. However, they were barely past the settling in stage when news of the death of Tommy's mother reached them in March 1955. She was aged 65. That same month, they were married in St. Joseph's Church, Highgate, North London. They lived in Warham Road, Haringey, London, where there was always welcome for musicians passing through, and later they resided in Muswell Hill, North London. Tommy worked at various jobs, including as a driver of heavy machinery, and particularly as a carpenter. Those who experienced his handiwork knew that he was a creative perfectionist in his craft as well as in his music. In 1957, Jacqueline, the first of four children, was born. Marion was born in 1959, Bernadette in 1961, and Tommy in 1967. All the children were to develop their own individual flair for music and were to become highly competent in a range of instruments. Jacqueline on concertina, Marion on whistle and later on pipes, Bernadette on piano and fiddle, and Tommy on fiddle. So how did this come about?
I never ever forced them to play or never once said, get out that flute or fiddle or anything like that, you know.
Mm.
It.
How did you encourage them?
Well, it just started with Jacqueline. She was the oldest. Talking about the concertina, you know, I never really owned a concertina, never. But I always could manage to lay my hands on one, even when I was at home here. But when we go to Mick Ryan, as they say, Stack, it was his concertina I'd play. I never had one, but... Many years ago, Sulis Lillis, God rest him, he sent me a concertina from Ireland to have it repaired over to London in a very bad state, inside in a shopping bag, in a Tesco shopping bag, mm-hmm. full of bits. And I took it to this man that I knew, and he repaired it. And when it was finished, he phoned me up and he said, Tom, it's ready now. Okay, I went and I collected it. And up in this little display cabinet he had, there was this lovely little one. So I said to him, and there was a price on it, £25. I said, whose is that? He said, it's mine. He said, you're selling it? I said, yeah. I said, okay, give it us. So I picked up Solis's concertina, and I came home with this other one. And I said to Kathleen, look what I bought. And she said, what do you want that for? So you got it anyway. I had it for a while. Jacqueline was about, I maybe nine, I'd say, roughly.
Mm-hmm.
So So, of course, she was pulling and dragging at it and fiddling around with it. And next thing, she picked up some little bit of a tune. How much is the dog in the window or something like that, you know? So, next thing, she started, she got some little bit of a tune in it and a couple of tunes and three tunes. And she was getting a little bit older, 12 and 14. And next thing, of course, we had the old competitions over there, two flies and all that. And she started going in for them. And I suppose she won a medal and, excuse me, and that was it. I started from there.
Hmm.
Then Marion come along and she started kind of with the tin whistle, bits of tunes, and then the two of them just be playing together at flies and duets and concerts and funerals and all this kind of thing, and that's how it started. Then Bernadette, they used to have piano lessons all night, classical music, a lady used to come in teaching them every Saturday. I don't know if they ever made much of a success at that, like, but she was, I can still remember her, she used to fall asleep teaching them.
No reflection on them, I hope.
No. But then, of course, they met up with other friends and they came home here and they learned tunes and things like that. And as you know, they married people that plays.
Indeed,
and
yeah. Did you teach them at home, or
well,
did they actually take lessons from other people in traditional music?
No, they never had any lessons. Mm. Never, no. I wouldn't say that I ever kind of sat down and taught them note by note. Mind you, I will say I think they picked it up fairly quick.
Yeah.
But maybe they might be playing a tune and I'd say, oh God, that doesn't sound too good or something, and try it this way, you know, that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And, you know, what would your advice be to parents who are maybe have young children today about to take an interest in music? I mean, some people will insist on them learning. Other people will try and use different methods. But what would your own experience
be? Well, everyone says to me, how did you manage to get four of them to play?
Mm-hmm.
But I didn't insist, as I told you, Tim, never.
Mm.
And I hear from teachers now, people that's teaching music, you know, the first thing the parents want is, when are they going to win a medal? But that's not the end of the story at all, you know, like, that's a shame. Do you know, medals aren't, I don't want to say this, our house should be full of medals. When I came back here from England, I'd thrown half of them out in the dump. Cups and saucers full of old medals, they don't mean a thing.
Yes.
It is encouragement, I must say, for children, but like...
they have to be put in the right place, I suppose.
They have, yeah.
Yeah.
They have. Yeah. But definitely don't force the children to play. Get a kind of a happy atmosphere, you know, that they like doing it. And mind you, I brought my kids out with me, you know, when they were very young too, and people often said to me, oh, you'll kill them children, Jesus, they should be at home in bed. But
you saw that as important, that they would experience,
you know,
the music.
Yeah, well, they were fond of it themselves then, you know, they were anxious to go out, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I didn't go out every night, but
mm-hmm.
when we'd go out, you know, it should be 11 or 12 o'clock before we get home, and they'd have to go to school in the morning, you know, mm-hmm. maybe once a week. And there might mm-hmm. be Irish dancing too, which is... They were never great at it, but just...
And apart from the music, for a minute, what was your experience of bringing up a family in London?
Look at Tim, you know, I haven't anything bad to say about it, and a lot of people used to say to me, gee, it must be very difficult to bring a family up over there, but, God, we never thought so, you know. My mm-hmm. wife seemed to think that, Kathleen thinks that it's easier to bring him up there than here.
Mm-hmm.
They're more under your hand kind of a way, you know. Mm-hmm. But... No, I wouldn't say anything about it, but to touch wood, as I say, we never had a bit of trouble with him.
Yeah,
you know?
Great.
Tommy and his family became deeply involved in the traditional music scene in London, and he was highly respected as a whistle, concertina player, and piper. He formed a musical partnership with Bobby Casey that lasted almost 40 years, and he spoke highly of Bobby's style, his repertoire, and his settings of tunes which he thought were ideally suited to the pipes. Willie Clancy was another big influence on him while Willie lived in London, and he never missed an opportunity to call and see Willie and to hear him play in Milton Malbay when the McCarty family returned for a holiday each year. Meanwhile, in London, the family was in constant demand at the traditional sessions and the more formal folk clubs that abounded at the time. They could be heard play in places like the Constitution in Camden Town on Saturday nights, in the Irish Centre on Sunday mornings where the young McCartys began playing in public, the Galtymore on Saturday and Sunday nights where the Glenside Kelly Band performed, the Hibernium in Fulham where there was a Coltus Kiltory Éireann session every Tuesday night, and the Victoria in Holloway Road, where they played at a session every Friday night from 1980 to 1989. From the purchase of his Leo Rousham set of pipes in 1950, and from the first tune in the cab of his truck in a side street in Dublin, Tommy's interest in this ancient instrument grew. In 1968, he attended the first meeting of the Pibri Illan in Bettystown, County Meath, and in 1980 he co-founded the London Pipers Club. In his article in Un Pibre, Tommy Keane wrote, and I quote, "Tommy's piping style was closer to Willie Clancy than to any other piper, and his relaxed and unhurried rhythm was a hallmark of his playing. Though he had learned concertina when he was young, Tommy never owned a concertina until he went to London, and after he had been playing the pipes for many years. This probably accounts for the fact that his concertina playing was very ornate with a piping flavour, and not typical of the style associated with the players from his local area. His whistle playing was also very expressive, and had that unmistakable Clare accent that came to him as naturally as speaking. He was very discerning in his choice of music, and once he took to a tune, he would make it his own." End quote. His short flirtation with Fawcett Circus at the young age of 17 didn't dispel from his mind notions of travel, and in 1972 he performed throughout the USA on the first Coltus Kiltory Éireann tour with musicians such as Paddy Glacken, Seamus Connolly and Joe Burke. They were invited back in 1982 to celebrate the 10th anniversary of that tour. Later he toured and performed in Britain, Brittany, Italy, Switzerland, the Netherlands, Bulgaria and Australia. Recording credits include contributions to albums by Kate Bush, John Anderson and Horslips. London theatre credits include music for a contemporary ballet called Sergeant Early's Dream and The Playboy of the Western World, which ran for 2 years at the National Theatre in London. Other work includes the music for the films Three Wishes for Jamie and Young Guns. He also performed regularly with Paddy Maloney and the Chieftains at their many London concerts. Then, in 1981, he was involved in this.
One night, many years ago, a man phoned me up from, I don't know who he was, from, but it was from a studio. And I never heard of the man in my life, and he said, he knew my name. He said, Tommy, he said, bring every tin whistle you have, and could you come over to the studio, something like 8 or 9 o'clock at night. And I gathered up all these tin whistles anyway, and off I went. And I got there, and he was a real nice guy, you know. He was playing that for me in a piano. He was playing it over and over and over, and we were trying all these tin whistles. And I think it finished up, I played an E flat. It was. I haven't got it now. God only knows where it is. But anyway, he said, yeah, that's lovely. And we were rehearsing this thing maybe for an hour over and over and over. And he said, that's lovely. And he recorded it. And he gave me, I don't know, 50 quid or something like that. It was all right. And I went home and I didn't think no more of it. And one day, maybe a month afterwards, I was a carpenter then. I was working in a house somewhere, and God, I had this radio downstairs blaring all day long, and every 15 minutes, you know, this thing was on it. And I had this tin whistle playing, and Jesus, I thought, that sounds familiar, you know. And I went down to this man who the radio was belonged to. He was a plumber. So I said to him, who is that? Who is that in the radio, John? He said, oh, he said, that's a group called Tight Fit. Oh, so even then I didn't know who they were, because I never met him. I just went to the studio and done my little bit. So I went on anyway, and God, it was on every radio and television, every 5 minutes of the day, you know. And then we used to have the Top of the Pops, was it? Whenever that was on there, you probably know, in evening time.
That's right.
And it was on that. Yeah. So next thing, the man at the studio phoned me up again and said, Tommy, he said, you'll have to come back again. He said, it's some union regulations. He said, we'll have to do that again. Oh, I said, okay. Because he said, it's going to be on Top of the Pops. So I went back again, and it was only kind of a mock-up thing. We'd done it again, but I didn't meet Tight Fit now. I did meet him afterwards, but I didn't meet him. And I'd done it again. And, of course, the next Tuesday night anyway. I wouldn't be certain now, but I think it was... it was number two, like, and then it was number one. It was number one for 7 weeks.
Very good, very good, very good. Yeah. You didn't actually appear on Top of the Pops.
Oh,
yourself.
No, I did not, no.
With the Tight Fit group. Yeah. What did they look like, anyway?
Well, you know, all I seen was on the television. I used to sit at home watching them. It was three of them, I think. The fella had a kind of a string, what do you call it, these string vests, and a girl. I think it was three of them. And they were there with all these actions and all that. And I was sitting at home watching the television. I used to hear this bit of tin whistle playing, you know.
You said, that's me.
That's me. But.
With the doom and gloom of the late 70s and early 80s receding in Ireland, many people began to think about returning home. For musicians, there was the added attraction of a flourishing music scene in Ireland at the time. Gradually, the McCarthy family began to return and set up home in Ireland between 1988 and 1990, and Kathleen and Tommy returned to the Mullock Road, Milltown Malbay, in 1991. Not alone do all the four family members play music themselves, but their partners are deeply involved and highly proficient in music. Tommy Keane, the Waterford piper, John Giles from Galway, who plays whistle, Henry Baina, the fiddle player from Tennessee, and Louise Costello from Thorlochmore, who plays accordion and banjo. Their children, the next generation, continue that trend. Not surprisingly, Tommy had a huge impact on the local music scene on his return to the Mullock Road. He could be heard at the various sessions in Clary's, Freel's, Quayle's, Clancy's, the Crosses of Anna, Gleason's of Coor, Conway's and Moroni's of Mullock, and many, many more. He recorded a special St. Stephen's Day broadcast with Clare FM Radio in 1992, recalling evocatively the visit of the Wren boys to his home in Sheehan in 1940. He returned to the radio studio in 1994 for a lengthy interview, and he became a regular radio performer at recordings during the Willie Clancy Summer School, at the Clare FM 10th anniversary, and at the kitchen sessions, which he loved, in Michael Mahoney's house near Milltown Malbay, and in Catherine Talty's of Clonlaheen, which was recorded in April 2000. The McCarthy family recorded a special television programme for T.G. Cahir, which was broadcast on New Year's Eve 1997. Tommy also performed in the production Out of the Heavens in Showers, a play by John Doherty based on the life of Michael Russell, which was performed in Clare and Galway in 1998 and 1999. I had the great pleasure of travelling with him and other friends to the Sidmouth International Folk Festival and to the smaller gatherings in South Kerry and in Connemara. He was the most charming and interesting person you could wish to be on tour with, as well as being totally professional and full of integrity while on stage. In the sleeve notes on his solo album, I refer to a visit he paid to my class in the CBS in Ennis to talk and to play for the children in the class, and his connection with these 10-year-olds was a revelation. Naturally enough, they were fascinated by the story of the Burning Flute when he himself was 10 years old in Kilmehel. He appears in no fewer than 10 albums, including Casey and the Cahos with Bobby Casey, which was recorded in 1992, Set Dances in Ireland, which he recorded with Michael Tubridy and Eamon McGivney, The Wind Among the Reeds, the recording made by Tommy Keane and Jacqueline McCarthy, and The Hidden Note, which is a solo album by his daughter Jacqueline. His solo album was released in 1997, and it surely is a lovely testament to his gentle, natural playing on whistle, concertina, and pipes. Tommy enjoyed immensely his trip to Boston College Gaelic Roots Festival in June 1999 with Bobby Casey and others. He knew the city well, of course, from his regular visits to and work on The Burn, the great music bar run by his son Tommy and Louise Costello. Less than a year later, on May the 13th, in the year 2000, Bobby Casey passed away, and Tommy and Maurice O'Rohan visited my radio programme on the following Thursday to share fond memories of his friend and colleague, Bobby. A month later, I was heading to the Boston College Festival myself, and I called to see him on my way to Shannon. Worryingly, he was due to travel to the Mater Hospital the following week for tests. When I was to see him again in early July, his health would have greatly deteriorated. He visited the Crosses of Anna on the last Monday of the Willie Clancy week for his first viewing of the family portrait by artist Cathy Kinkham. Despite his weakened condition, his spirit and fondness for the music never waned, and he played at Fleana Guach in Kinvara and at the Galway Arts Festival, giving his last public performance at HMSS Crotty in August 2000. The following week, he journeyed to his home in Sheehan to visit his brother, Paddy, and his stepsister, Margaret. He was accompanied on that trip by his son, Tommy, and film producer, Ken Lynham. He played a few tunes on concertina in his own kitchen, and as they returned home to Milton Malbay, he evoked the memories and the place names of his youth. It was a dignified farewell trip, as Tommy passed away peacefully 2 days later, on the 23rd of September, Irish time, after travelling to Lourdes with his wife, Kathleen. If the last months still present themselves as a blur, his music and his company remain vivid. His entrance to Clancy's or Freel's about 10:30, sliding the concertina to a safe place on the floor with his left hand, acknowledging friends with a right thumbs-up sign, ordering a pint of Guinness, and talking the topics of the day before any note could be played. Most of all, there was Quayle's pub on a Sunday morning. The conversation was relaxed, and on a wet November day, with the temptation to have one more before the dinner, and discussion might range anywhere from how the Chinaman got his name, to joining the circus, to someone pulling a banister rail down on himself in Camden Town with a dint of madness and pleasure in the music. For, to Tommy, nothing was without importance. In his 70 years, music was to play a pivotal role in his life, yet he was never evangelical about it. Perhaps he treated it as he might a favourite plant or tree, with love and care and a desire to nurture. This deep and subtle love he passed on to all his family, and in this care of something that he saw not as precious so much as natural, we were all touched. It was a privilege to have known this talented, generous, humorous, and most humble of men. In September 2000, his daughter Bernadette paid this tribute to him on behalf of the family, and I quote, "As we grew into our teens, we never felt the need to rebel, simply because to be in his company was always such an unpredictable pleasure. When you went out, you could end up anywhere, from a rock star's party to a poetry reading to a traveller's caravan. In that respect, he never changed to the day he died." End quote. And perhaps Jackie Small's one-line tribute eloquently says it all. "Tommy McCarthy, master, musician and craftsman, who did not touch anything he did not adorn. May his spirit always keep our spirits high. May we always hear the strains of Un Buachalín Bón on whistle, the sweetness of Sporting Nell on concertina, and the pulse of the pipes on the road to Liston Varna. And may our thoughts always dance with his as we take a trip over the mountain."